This is the Christian Heritage London podcast from London.
It's fantastic to be sitting here at last with Tim Chaddick. How are you, Tim?
I'm well. I'm jet-lagged, but happy to be here with you and to talk about the gospel.
There you go. And I'm not surprised to hear you say that, because what I know of you is this. Let's go plant a church. Let's go somewhere else and plot a church.
Habit. A holy habit, I suppose.
That's the best kind of holy habit.
Yeah,
that's better than one you can wear.
Yeah, although I'm feeling it now that I'm in my 40s. I'm like, maybe I best transition to training other people to do that at this stage. But it has been a part of our story since I became a Christian and got called into ministry.
That is interesting. And you are pastor now of a church called Reality Ventura, am I right?
Correct. Yeah, it's just north of Los Angeles, and it's a part of a smaller family of churches. There's 9 churches in our family that go back to the year 2003, so I've been involved in that for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And you also planted a church in London, so you are quite at home here. You know how the tube works. You stand on the right.
Stand on the right. Yeah, and cringe when you hear the very loud American groups. I'm like, oh, I'm not with them, you know. I'm sorry.
When I walk around with a camera, I always feel like, you know, you sort of feel like I should have a sign. No, I do live here.
Yes. Yeah, because it can look very touristy.
Yeah. And you are here with a team at the moment who are here with missional intent. Want to tell us about that, Luke?
We brought over a, generally not the best wisdom to bring a giant group from California to London, but we have just over 60 people, young adults as well as teenagers. They're going to be serving at a Christian outreach festival next week in the southwest of England, but we're spending a week in London. We spent some time with you today learning about how the gospel's transformed London and the world, and then we'll be doing some mercy ministry and street evangelism and whatnot for the rest of the week.
So, fantastic.
Great trip.
So you're getting, you're seeing we are going to invest with these people as well as them being invested into, and that would seem to be basically obvious to you.
It's so fruitful, not only in the work that they do on the ground as we do this yearly, but the transformation that it brings to them when they go back home and to our church to have that gospel mindset, mission mindset. I love being a part of taking teams to different places because it just takes you outside of your ordinary rhythms and reminds you, oh, I can be in ordinary life with gospel intentionality everywhere that I go. So I love it.
That's beautiful. And when you were here last year, we had the privilege of having a lady joining with us, sweet lady, who was investigating, trying to understand Christianity. And what was precious was that it was your ladies who really got around her and chatted with her and were friendly.
It's beautiful.
And then later, I hear, she's made a profession of faith.
She came to this service that we had at the church we planted here, Reality Church London, a few days after you led the tour through her intrigue and interest. And then that sparked a ongoing conversation with some of our team. And then she eventually made a profession of faith. And it's been over a year now, and she's still following Jesus in a very secular, high-pressure environment. She's like, telling everyone to read Reason for God by Tim Keller. And, you know, she's just, it's bearing fruit. So it's incredible.
But this is what's fascinating. You see, there's something very simple about it. Mm. And what was happening was that your dear ladies were just friendly to her and loving to her. And I'd be preaching away, oh, and then they would say, you know, that's what this means. And she'd say, but what is this? And they'd say, oh, it means this. And you know, it's funny because, of course, people become Christians on the walk. Yeah. And people say, oh, isn't that great? And I say, I was the last cog. There were a number of cogs that got to this.
It was a beautiful microcosm of, I think, what we long to see in our local churches. Because you were that day on the tour, you were essentially doing the preaching. But there, this guest was alongside our people who was just able to process, ask some follow-up questions. Our team, they didn't have to prepare the talks that you had prepared, but they were able to follow up and to pray and to ask questions and to give more resources. And I think a lot of people feel pressure. Well, I have to share a 3-point, you know, sermon with my friend. No. Share your story. Obviously, share the simplicity of the gospel. But sometimes it's, here, listen to the sermon. Come to church with me. Read this book.
Yeah.
And then you can just follow up on that, even though these authors, writers, thinkers have kind of done the heavy lifting. You can just follow up on that and pray for them and talk to them, and
come on,
the results are beautiful.
Yes, it's body. It's body ministry together. That's wonderful. And I love that. I love that priority. How did you come to understand the gospel yourself?
I was born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area of California, so just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. known in the States as typically progressive, you know, politically and otherwise. It's a very, very fascinating part of the country. I like to say everybody there believes in science and crystals. There's like this deeply intellectual kind of, you know, highbrow type of culture there, but it's also mixed with this crazy California, like aliens and tinfoil hats, and, you know, just wild, like very wild. A lot of my teachers growing up in school were ex-hippies from the 60s and 70s who had kind of settled down and became our school teachers, you know. Wow. So I remember going to school and all the classrooms were filled with all this, you know, kind of new age, at least that's what it was called back then, you know, paraphernalia in the classrooms and whatnot. So very secular environment, but my parents were Christians. Mm-hmm. They had become Christians during what we often call the Jesus movement in the 70s,
wow,
which was part of the Calvary Chapel church movement there. And they moved to Northern California to be a part of a church, which when I was young, fell apart, essentially. There was a church split. It was very hurtful for my parents. We moved to a different town. And so my impression of the church growing up was very negative. Mm. My parents were very hurt. My dad's health started to decline, and he ended up getting some very, very horrible illnesses that eventually led to his death a long time ago. So my brother and I grew up in this very secular environment with parents who believed but were very wounded, and my father is essentially like dying. And so my brother and I, he's older, we were very bitter. Like, I don't, my parents, I respect them, but I hate God. I hate the church. I kind of want to have nothing to do with it. And I never met another Christian, you know, going to school there. I think a lot of people have this idea of the States as, you know, everywhere you go, there's Christians everywhere. And that might be true in certain parts of the country, but definitely not where I grew up. I didn't know anyone that went to church. Mm. And so that led my brother and I just into the all the typical teenage craziness. I got very involved in drugs and partying, like as early as 13, and just went absolutely wild, and that marked our young years, and it was terrible.
You're the second brother.
I'm the second brother. Mm-hmm. We were both equally bad, just in very different ways, and it was part of how we were just coping with my dad's declining health, our kind of bitterness about the idea of God and church and all that. And then, I mean, part of it was just I wanted to do what I wanted to do. Mm. But that led to a very dark place when I was about 19 years old, just the sexual promiscuity, the substances. I was playing in bands, all these like punk rock bands in the Bay Area in the 90s, which at the time was a very cool thing. So people would be familiar with Green Day and mm-hmm. those types of band. That was from my area of the Bay. So that was kind of the era I grew up in. Very depressed, completely empty. And this really annoying Christian girl that I had met at an event kept ringing me and trying to invite me to these Christian events. And I always said no. But one day I said yes. And I was hungover. I had been partying all night, got to my home at like 4 a.m. And she calls me at 8 a.m. And I woke up and call it a miracle. I was completely sober. And she's on the phone and she says, you need to come to this event. It's down in San Jose, which was a 2-hour drive from where I was, which normally wouldn't make any sense. Mm. I felt compelled. I was like so depressed. I'm like, I have to go. And I got up, I showered, got dressed, drove 2 hours, and I went to this event, and there was tons of people there. It was the south side of the Bay Area, which is well-populated, and there's a lot more Christians down there. It's this big church. I hated the music. I hated everything they did. I hated the whole event. I'm very, like, especially being from the Bay Area, I was a music snob. I was like, this is terrible. This is what Christians do. You know, I was like, oh, I was so judgmental. I was like 19. There's all these younger people there. I'm like, why did I come to this? And then the preacher came out and he just started preaching the gospel. And I get emotional just thinking about it to this day. It was just the clarity of the gospel. And in that moment, I knew that I could be forgiven. I mean, when I was younger, I had paid for abortions. I had carried all that like shame and guilt with me. And he's saying, no matter what you've done, no matter how far you've gone, you know, Christ died for you and you don't have to pay for your sin. He paid for your sin. And I just started weeping. And then they did the traditional, you know, altar call. And I was like, I'm not going. And whatever people think about altar calls or whatever, it doesn't really matter. For me, I felt compelled. Like I had to do this. I had to make what was happening in my heart become expressed in my decision to follow Jesus. And so I received the gospel, and I was so excited that I was forgiven that I ended up sleeping in the gymnasium that the church had owned, even though I didn't even bring a set of clothes because I just didn't want to. I was like, this is holy ground. You know, I want to stay here. And I slept overnight and just started chatting with people. And then on my way home, I kept stopping to the payphones along the way, because this is before mobile phones, and calling my friends. And I'm like, my life just changed. And they're like, what? Yeah. What are you talking about? I'm a Christian. And they're like, oh, no. And I've never been the same since. So that's how my 19. Journey with Christ at 19.
Come on. Wow. And the girl, she's like
really annoying. She was so annoying. And I honestly, I think I talked to her once after that.
Really?
Which is in itself a beautiful story, because I think we often get discouraged. Maybe I invited someone to an event or a church service, and you may never see the fruit of that, but God used that young woman to lead me to that event where I was led to Christ. And I have no idea if she knows. I don't even remember her name. I think it was Julie or something. But when I get to heaven, it would be great.
That is, yeah, and as you say, it does not fit the mo. Right, there's this. No, it's out of nowhere. An annoying girl told me the gospel.
Cheesy music. Yeah, none of it. I judged the whole thing. And I still, to this day, I do cringe a little bit when I see it, from my perspective, when the church feels like it has to try so hard to, you know, I'm not anti-production, nothing like that. I don't overthink it. But I do feel as if, and I've heard this anecdotally a lot in the church, that unless we get this, then, you know, the power of the gospel won't really shine. And I'm like, you know, yeah, have a decent sound system if you can afford it, sure. But people can get saved through it. Yeah, the means doesn't really matter. It's the message. And
that was your thing, wasn't it? It was the message.
That's right.
This, I need that.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. We have a great deal in common in the sense I was 19, and I was invited over to the U.S. to tour America with a Christian rock band.
Okay.
Which I like the idea of tour America with a rock band. I like that.
Yeah.
And they were in Southern California.
Okay.
And they were
the Holy Land.
No, yeah, this is it. They were night by night. And outstanding musicians, no question. Incredible musicians. But the singer would just preach. He wouldn't preach. He would just talk about the cross. And he would talk about, you know, the horror. Some of the things I said on the walk today, which still, his face was marred more than any man. You don't tend to hear that, you know. Mm-hmm. And his form beyond human likeness. And he, like one from whom men hide their faces. And you're hearing that night by night, and you're thinking, but because what you see, what I need is going to have to be comprehensive. Mm-hmm. You know, it can't just be, yeah, a bit of advice, you know, try this. It has to be, and also the guys in this band, they were not self-righteous. He's my righteousness.
Yeah.
And so I just want to live for him now. It seemed very simple. And I thought, well, that's, and it took me a few times, but then I was also at 19, and I also went forward in Southern California.
That's amazing.
Isn't it extraordinary? But
it is.
But isn't it wonderful? It's the message. Because I fear that growing up in the church kind of thing, you could feel like it's a bit embarrassing. And
yeah.
No, but the issue is, no, our message is flipping awesome.
Where I grew up, California is quite large. And spiritually speaking, Northern California is very different than Southern California. So anyone listening might be familiar with a lot of well-known churches. They're usually in Southern California. They're not in, you know, kind of where I grew up. When I moved down to Southern California, I went to a Bible school that was run by Calvary Chapel churches. And that's the first time I ever went to like big churches. I never even knew that was a thing. And seeing the campuses and the, you know, the big worship centers and the schools and all that. I was like, wow, what is this? And I didn't know there was like Christian rock genres. You know, I didn't even know that was a thing. People were like, oh, if you listened to, you know, this band in the 90s, you'll love Delirious or something like that. I was so unaware of that because it's not a thing in Northern California. So culturally, I remember going down there and seeing the cars with the little stickers, you know, Jesus stickers on the car. I'm like, oh, you don't see that where I'm from. Yeah, well. But I realized how much that shaped a lot of my approach to ministry was, especially years later when God called my wife and I to move to LA and we planted a church in Hollywood in 2005. We kind of wanted it to be the anti-cool church, you know, like we're deliberately not going to try to do anything flashy or showy. I'm not trying to moralize like a style or anything, but I realize how much of my sensibilities in ministry were shaped by not only how I grew up and where I grew up, but even the manner in which God saved me. Was there was nothing I really liked about the occasion per se, but it was the power of the message, and thankfully nothing drowned that out. I think sometimes there's so much hype put on everything else, the entertainment and the whatever, and sometimes sadly the message can get lost in that, but that was not the case for this event I went to. And so I made a commitment that whatever we do, and whatever level it's at in terms of how we're, you know, running our services and all that, the point is always the clarity of the message.
Like,
that's where the power is, and that's it. And everything else is just, you know, sure, God provides us with things, use whatever you have, great. But it's all about the clarity of the message.
Yeah, and that's what actually helps people. And when one thing I notice with you is you are among the people. That is very distinctive. So we were looking today, I'm saying about, I wonder if there's some people over there are getting what I'm saying. He said, I have already seen that. You're aware of what's going on with the group. And as we're walking among the group, we've got 60 people, and there's Tim Chaddick, and he's making sure everyone's catching, everyone's walking. You're among the people. And you see that as an obvious consequence of this
gospel. No-brainer.
Yeah.
No-brainer. Yeah. I identify with the people in question. We're some of the younger people on our trip, and I saw them on the fringe, and I told one of our leaders, I'm like, hey, we're outside. We're doing this tour. I'm afraid that they're going to be on the fringe. I'm not going to like hear this. So I want you to make sure that you go around and kind of push them in the fringe, because I was one of those people.
Yeah, man.
I was one of the fringe people, and God's like pushing me in. So
I love it.
I can't. When I think of preaching, when I do preaching classes and courses and whatnot, I often will do a section on, you know, just when you're obviously preaching to the unconverted, you know, in a room, because who knows who's going to show up, you know, to any gathering. But I say for me, every Sunday, I always picture the person at the back with their arms folded thinking like, why should I listen?
Mm.
Not that I'm going to impress them or anything, but I want to make sure that I will do whatever it takes to get their attention, to pay attention to Christ. Like,
yeah.
That unction, that
I love,
because I just think of that was me.
Yeah.
I'm preaching to my former self in many ways.
But that what's beautiful about that also is there's a stability that comes from that push. You sit on a bicycle, I've said it many times, you sit on a bicycle and it's stationary, you're going to fall over one way. You only get balance from moving forward.
That's right.
And you're saying, let's go. Yep. And you're saying, the person, I really want them to get it.
Yep.
That is not something that everyone's seeing.
Yeah, I think, you know, that definition, preaching is truth mediated through personality. You know, I think God obviously uses our stories and whatever. The Spirit obviously uses us, just like he uses all the different parts of the body. And I think in a very beautiful way, and we hear it in a lot of our friends and peers, their own experience of the gospel and resonating with people with whom maybe they have a shared history or background, you're just naturally mindful of those things. And so when you're preaching and you're engaging in people, you can't help but to think about that. And then there's this huge benefit for the church itself, because as they're being edified, they're also thinking, I would love it if everyone in our church every Sunday says, I wish my friend was here today.
Yeah, baby.
I wish my mother-in-law was here today. I wish my grandparents were here. I wish my children were here today. Like, you want that edifying the church, but also evangelizing the lost in the same context, because who knows?
But
who knows who's
in
the
room? You see, the issue is, a lot of people, I fear, and especially at the moment, because there is a crisis, genuinely, as I understand it, in leadership, there's a lot of people whose preaching is very flavored by, I need to keep everyone happy.
Right.
And if you come with that, I fear you are actually, it's like you can't keep a plant happy just by dealing with the flowers. You've got to get to the roots.
Yeah.
Now, there's something about these roots, which is we got to deal with the purpose of the thing. And the purpose of the thing is moving forward.
You'll know this better than I do, because I believe, do you run Spurgeon's Twitter account as well?
It's one of the ones I don't.
Okay, one of the ones you don't, yeah. But, you know, there's, like in lectures to my students, you know, famously in my own paraphrase of it, is the first thing you got to do is settle your convictions. You know, young preachers, settle your convictions before the ministry opportunities, before the challenges, before the obstacles, and before the opportunities. What do I actually believe about the gospel? What do I believe about the preaching of God's word? Because as you and I both know, not everybody believes the same thing about the role of preaching and all those things. And I'm so grateful for the years that I was discipled, and I'm really grateful to the Calvary Chapel movement. I worked at a Calvary Chapel for several years where I got ordained before I joined the Reality Network later on, because they just ingrained in my mind and my heart the power of expository preaching and Christ-centered preaching. So before, when I was young and my wife and I go to Hollywood to preach, I don't want to be pulled by the opinions of people or the demands, the consumer demands. I want to go in there with my convictions. Like, what do I believe is true? What's my job?
Mm-hmm.
What is my job? If Christ has called me to be a minister and to be a preacher, what is my job? Well, my job is to be a servant of Christ and a servant of the word. Like, the text, for me, the text sets the agenda.
Yeah, baby.
People might say things, they like it, they don't like it, and I just honestly am like, oh, okay, that's interesting. That's good to know. That's helpful. But none of that changes what I'm actually supposed to do. It might help inform how I apply something or maybe introduce something or handle an issue, but like, none of that's going to change, hopefully not change my convictions. Mm. And like you mentioned, I see so many people who just tossed to and fro by the politics of the day and a lot of the hot topics. A lot of those are very important, but even the way in which we address those can shape the culture of a church. If we're always the tail wagging the dog, then we're only just doing these topical things all the time. We start with the topic and then kind of find the Bible verse to, you know, support it, rather than, hey, we'll acknowledge this, but we're going to the text.
And even history has been changed by, you know, it shows us the people who actually got it that way around were the ones who actually made a difference to anything. And frustratingly, Tim, I noticed that some of the people who are quoted by people who are not known for this pioneering push, they themselves were pioneering like anything.
That's right.
They were just, you've got to hear this. You've got to hear what Jesus is. Yeah. You're to see Jesus. You know?
That's right.
I mean, John Owen, you know, I run one of the Twitter accounts I run. He just wants you to see Jesus. That's he really does want you to see Jesus.
Yep.
And I'm so grateful to read Owen, because sometimes when you're reading something awesome in Colossians or something, you think, well, I'm sure, I wonder what John Owen would say there.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you read John Owen, no, he really is saying that. You
know? Yeah. One of the eras that I'm so fond of when I was pastoring in LA was, we were going through a series on temptation, and here we are in Hollywood, and we're tackling this topic, you know, of temptation. We're quoting Owen, like, you know, be killing sin or sin will be killing you. And just seeing all these young people in Hollywood, they're just like eating it up,
baby,
because it was so substantial.
Yeah.
Like, there was nothing flashy about it. It's like they just got hit, like, oh, this is the truth that I need to navigate the world in which I live without losing my soul.
Come on.
And if I actually want to be an influence, I can't seek to be an influence. I need to seek Christ.
Yeah.
And as I seek Christ, then I become the influence. Because everyone there, they're like, okay, yeah, I'm a Christian, but what can I do to be influential? It's like, no, your priority's wrong there. Like, encounter Christ and allow him to shape and reshape every part of you. And then as a result of that, you will be the influence, the salt and light that he wants you to be.
That's outstanding.
Yeah.
And also, it's what so many of these great guys have said.
That's
one of the wonderful benefits of reading these heroes. But I'm just so intrigued and fascinated by your early goal, moving to Hollywood, saying, we're going to be the ones who are not going to be cool. I just think that is so much fun.
It was fun. I kind of, and again, some of that's just my personality. I think, you know, the kind of punk rock mentality of the Bay Area of California.
So, is there any funny example you have of that? Did you have, like, you give everyone a hymn book as they come in?
Well,
hey,
we did not have a lot of resources when we started. The church is called Reality LA. So in 2005, you know, we start and we're meeting in like a tiny elementary school in Central Hollywood. And it's so unimpressive. And, you know, there's like Frosty the Snowman because of a previous Christmas pageant that they did in there, up on the walls of the, you know, I mean, it's just decorate. It's all the school stuff everywhere, and the sound wasn't very good. And don't get me wrong, I love music. I play music. Like, I like good music. I don't think you should play bad music on purpose, you know. But we always knew that, in as much as we want to try to do things well, we knew that in and of itself is not going to change people.
This is it.
So we're like, you know what? The main attraction factor should be the presence of Christ, the preaching of his word, you know, in a gathered setting. We're just going to make it all about that. And so for the first year or two, we all know church planning, like it's so hard and can be so exciting and so discouraging all at the same time. Mm-hmm. I often tell young church planners, hey, be faithful and results may vary. Like the parable of the sower. So the church was, you know, we probably had like 50 or 60 people, I think probably in that first, you know, year or two. And there was this young man, he was in his early 20s. He was a graduate of USC, or he's still at USC at the time. His name is Chase. He was just one of those guys who was everybody's friend. He knew people at USC. He knew people, you know, in the entertainment industry. He just had tons of friends, so much favor. He loved Jesus.
Wow.
And his faith was contagious. And in our little gathering, he would always fill a row with like his friends. He'd just bring people to church, bring people to church.
Come on.
And then in our second year, he had a terrible accident. He went into a coma for 3 months and then he died.
Oh.
It was so sad. However, during those 3 months, while he was in a coma, all of his friends, like everyone he knew, they were distraught over Chase's, at the time, what they didn't know if he was going to make it, and eventually he didn't. They said, well, we don't know how to deal with this. We don't even know how to deal with death. We're all young. We thought all of our best years are ahead of us. They said, well, where can we go to get answers? And like, well, Chase would go to church. That's where he would go. So all these young people just started coming to church. Like during those 3 months, we'd get like 10, 20, 30, like young people, just his friends, like coming to church. When he died, 1,000 people showed up at his memorial, like as a testament to his love for Christ, his character. Wow. And then after that, it was like all those people kept coming. And we, and I hate the numbers thing, but it was significant because it had nothing to do with anything that we were doing per se, other than just my sermons were like mediocre, just a solid 5.5 out of 10, you know, whatever. It's going through the Gospel of John. But we're giving him Jesus. And week after week, it was like, it went like 100, 120, 150, 200 people. And I would preach a sermon, and then we'd have a time of response, and these young people would just come down to the front, just like weeping and like going to get prayer and like receiving communion. And it just, it just went crazy. We ended up having to like move locations to another school and then to another school, and it just kept rolling on. But the beautiful thing about it was it started with the testimony of a young man who just loved Jesus, and he suffered, and he, you know, in our time frame, it was a very untimely, you know, it was very sad. It was very sad. And yet, like you mentioned this morning on our tour, the grain of wheat falling into the ground and yet producing life, that's how our church grew.
Come on.
And I'm like, I didn't read that in a church planning manual, you know, like
no kidding.
Somebody, you know, loves Jesus, is very influential, dies suddenly, and his testimony leads many people to Christ. Like you can't manufacture any of those things.
Yeah.
But we were giving them Jesus.
Yes.
But nobody, when you ask anyone who received Christ during those days and got saved and baptized, nobody will ever say the music was awesome.
Right.
They won't even say the sermons were awesome. They will say, like, the Bible was preached and Christ was preached.
On.
And that's what changed my life. And I was
love
like,
it.
That's all we got.
That's beautiful.
That's all we got.
That is wonderful. And I love the fact, it's like, you know, it's like in sport. The guy's running, he might get the ball.
Yep.
And if he's running, if he's not running, he's not going to get the ball.
He's not going to get the
ball. But if he's running, he might get it. And you were running at the time. And it's like the Lord, we see a tiny bit of it. You say a tiny bit of it.
Yeah.
I saw a wonderful quote. Was it, peace doesn't come from knowing what God is doing. Peace comes from knowing it's God who's doing it, which I think is awesome.
Brilliant.
That's our gospel, isn't it?
That's right.
We know what God's doing. So come on, let's go. Let's see what he'll do.
Yeah, and I can rest in that.
Hey, come on.
The pressure's off. The weight, you know, as anyone in ministry, they know there's always that temptation to think, I have to manufacture something. I have to produce something. And it's just constant reminder of preaching to ourselves. No, I'm the messenger. I preach Christ. He does the work.
Come on. That's wonderful. So there in Hollywood, you've been associated with various actors who become Christians and so on. Are there any stories you can tell us about that? Because what's it like living in Hollywood, bumping into probably a lot of people who want to be actors as well as actors?
Yeah. And I mean, Hollywood's just crazy. There's actors, and then there's ex-criminals. There's people addicted to all manner of substances. And then there's just, you know, people who work in law, or they work for the city. You know, it's just, it's a little bit of everything. There's a lot of expats, you know, it's just kind of a wild place. So it's beautiful because you do get this mix of the, you know, the up and in and the down and out, you know. And my first counseling appointment, I think it was, we were 3 months in to the church, and I get my first email of like, requesting, you know, counseling from a young guy who's an actor. And I'm like, oh, I got my first appointment. You know, I'm like 26. I'm like, you know, I'm a minister. You know, I go with my Bible under arm and I show up to this apartment in West Hollywood and I knock on the door and he opens it up and there's cocaine everywhere.
Wow.
Everywhere. Like Scarface type, just everywhere. And I was like, do I go in? Am I going to get arrested? Like, they didn't teach me this in Bible college. Yeah, like, what do I do? And I was like so afraid. I'm like, I can imagine it now. Like, pastor, found with like, you know, pounds of cocaine or whatever. And I told the guy, hey, can we sit outside? You know, just, you know, I wasn't trying to be like holier than thou. I was genuinely afraid. So, you know, we like meet outside and, you know, just dealing with all the identity issues that Hollywood brings up, especially in the entertainment industry. And, you know, stories like that, you know, are, I mean, so numerous that someday I want to sit down and write my like memoirs of that, like things I saw from the pulpit in Hollywood. Because the pressures are, you know, there's temptation everywhere. It's a very unique place, and particularly so for people who do work in entertainment, because it's intense in a way that is very unique and very difficult and not normal. It's not subtle, you know, it's so in your face. Maybe a little bit more so than if you're just kind of, you know, working in banking or something like that. Mm-hmm, like obviously there's evil everywhere, temptation everywhere, but it's wild. It's very intense. And seeing those people wrestle with that, and whether they're learning about Jesus or they are Christians, but they're trying to maintain faithfulness in that industry.
I was interested in your book, Better. You come at these things, but you don't just throw on, tick a box. Yeah, the gospel saves it. You come from Ecclesiastes.
Yes.
Let's look at what the Bible says about these different questions. Did you know, I like the way you answered the question early on. Did you know that the Jesus has, there are various questions God wants to ask you, and you get into it articulately, and you serve the people in that sense.
Ecclesiastes was a very, studying the book at that time in LA, which I think was around 2012, 2013, it was an amazing book to study together at that time for those people because of the nature of the book, just wrestling with, you know, the kind of meaning of life and the meaning crisis and all that, but exploring it through all these different topics. And you mentioned this morning, you know, that all roads lead to Christ when we're teaching scripture. And it was such a beautiful way of addressing the issues that Ecclesiastes does, which everyone deals with in Hollywood. It's like money, identity, community, pleasure, you know, all these different things, but then using that as a springboard to Christ every single time was so powerful and so meaningful, because we can address those topics, but in the end, that's not the main thing. You know, that's our opportunity to come to Christ. And going through that book was amazing at that time for those people. And that's what the book was kind of born out of.
I like that though, because apart from anything else, there's not a lot of books, you know, say, well, let's deal with this subject by going through Ecclesiastes.
Yeah. Verse by verse.
Come on. That's cool. So who have been people who have inspired you?
I'd say a couple that I knew in person and a couple, you know, that have long gone and entered into glory, but who were influential through their writings. The first one would be Brian Broderson, who is the pastor of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa.
Oh, bless him.
He spent time in the 90s here in London. He planted Calvary Chapel Westminster and was influential in helping other Calvary Chapels get started in the UK as well as Europe. I was a new Christian, and I go to Bible college in 1999. He moves back from London, I think in that year or the year. Yeah, it was in 99. And I meet him, and I'm this young, new, you know, convert. I think I'd been a Christian for, I don't know, X amount of months. What? But I signed up for Bible school because I thought it would be a good idea and I would just get out of the San Francisco Bay Area, and it was cheap. So I was like, sure, sign me up. I didn't know about call or anything. And then Brian comes and he does all these lectures for us at this Bible college, probably about 500 students at the time on this campus. And when I heard his stories of church planning and then going to London and, you know, preaching the gospel to secular people, I was like, I like this guy. So I go up after one of the lectures and I meet him, and, you know, we kind of get on, and I find out his son's remotely close to my age and we're all into music and all that stuff. And he's like, well, what are you going to do with your life? I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out. I think I'd like to serve in the church. And, you know, and he says, you know what? Why don't you come on a trip with me? I'm like, I just meet him. So he's like, just think about it. You know, because I go back to the UK often, you know, maybe you can get to know my son. And I was like, wow, this is cool. So a few weeks later, he continues his lectures and he says, hey, so I'm going to go on a trip. I'm going to buy you a ticket and you're going to come to London with me. And we're just going to see what God's up to, visit some of the churches. You can hang out with my son. And that started like essentially a mentoring relationship with him. I go on my first trip to London. It was January 1st, the year 2000. I come here and, you know, we visit all these different churches and I got to know him and I got to learn more about his philosophy of ministry. And he was one of those guys that to this day, he always takes chances on younger people. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're like, man, if there's fruit in their life, fruit of the Holy Spirit, gospel conviction, like I'll roll the dice essentially and like give him an opportunity. So it was amazing. He just kind of took a chance on me and I got to know him and I was dating a girl at the time. We were about to get engaged and he offered me my first job. So in 2001, I start work at his church and then I enter into as an assistant or intern pastor, then an assistant pastor, and then I got ordained. And it's all because of the opportunity that he gave me when he did not have to. He also introduced me to Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. And he, when I was wrestling with, should I do ministry? Like, I think I might teach. And he said, read this.
Okay.
Kind of like the Jedi mind trick. He's like, read this. And it was Preaching and Preachers. Oh, and I was like, okay, I like the cover. The cover's cool. You know. And I start reading it and I'm like, this guy, this is amazing. And then I get to the chapter where Lloyd-Jones goes on about Romans 10 and, you know, the way that the format of the book is laid out. It's got the quotation of the scripture before the body of the chapter. And it's Romans 10, how shall they hear without a preacher?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably the beginning of 2001. I was in my dorm room reading that. And when I read that verse, not even going into the chapter, just that verse in that moment, the Spirit of God was like, you're called to be a preacher.
Wow.
And I was excited and terrified. And I think I'm supposed to do this. And so then that changed how I read the rest of the book. And then that began a relationship with Lloyd-Jones. And I just got everything I could. I'd buy all the different copies of the Romans series, you know, different eras. Yeah. Also love the cover. It's just,
they are cool.
When it's all together, it's just glory, this glorious rainbow of Romans, you know.
Yeah.
And then all of his other stuff, you know, spiritual depression and Ephesians, you know, just all that. And I'm like, I love this. And that was kind of my window into like a little bit of reform theology, but with the charismatic emphasis, which is what I was used to, and then expository preaching. And I mean, so one of my heroes absolutely would be Brian Broderson. And then he leads me to, you know, Lloyd-Jones, which then leads me to, of course, you know, I go down the rabbit hole and you discover all the other writers. Cause I didn't know about all that. I just started learning it in Bible college and would just, I'd literally go into the bookstore and I'm looking at some of these like, I remember the first time I remember the first time I saw the Metropolitan, you know, Tabernacle Pulpit book. And I would just buy it cause I liked the cover and I thought it was cool. And I would just read it. I was like, Spurgeon's amazing.
It was
incredible.
You were being cared for there. There was something providential about that.
Yeah, it was awesome. But looking back on it now, I was like, this is awesome. I do the first, whenever I'm in a room with books, I'm like, it's just incredible. And then obviously the years go by and then you get into more ministry specific and church planning. And though he's an influence to, you know, millions, Tim Keller was so formative for me in approaching preaching to a secular environment and, you know, planting.
Yes.
When I was in LA, somebody had given me a CD, like MP3 CD of this Presbyterian preacher. And I'm like, I didn't know anything about, you know, these modern day Presbyterians. I was like, I don't really listen to Presbyterians. I don't think. Maybe I should broaden my diet, you know? Yeah. And so I remember putting the CD in the player of my car, and it was Tim Keller's series on Jonah.
Oh, really?
You know, from the early 2000s or late 90s, you know, how should I not love that great city?
Yeah.
And I just remember crying in my car, driving on Sunset Boulevard, listening to Tim Keller talking about how we need to preach the gospel to a city. And then that got me down, you know, that rabbit hole, and then wanting to learn about his Christ-centered church planning strategy and all the stuff that would become his Center Church book. And I'd email them and, you know, ask them for material and all that, like everyone was doing back in the day. And but he became so formative. And actually the guy who was my successor here in London worked with Tim for 10 years and has actually just gone back to take the position of senior minister at Redeemer in New York, which is incredible.
Extraordinary.
So there's just been a whole connection there, and you know, had the opportunity to spend time with their staff and him over the years. So there was different eras, like Brian Broderson, God used him as a mentor in my calling. And then people like Lloyd Jones was very much about my preaching and my love for the preaching of the word. And then the Tim Kellers of the world was very much about, how do you think about ministry and church planning in light of the gospel? Those are kind of three very distinct categories for me of influence.
And it's interesting, each one seems to be like an introduction to a friend, literally in Brian's case. And then you get to know, there's that old adage that, you know, you get to know someone who's from church history, have them be your friend, go with them. And Lloyd Jones has been extraordinary in that way. Did you know that the Preaching and Preachers series, which you can now hear, I don't know if you know, but when you hear him preach, it's this extraordinary authority.
And a great Welsh accent.
No kidding.
The wrath of God.
When I take people on the Westminster tour, I tell the story of him in the chapel there, and how it changed my parents' life. You know, and then my dad started a whole movement of churches, which, you know, 3,000 churches in the end. And I can say those foundations that my dad preached were essentially Lloyd Jones on Romans 5-8. So there's so extraordinary consequences. But his the preaching he did, compared with the lectures he gave on Preaching and Preachers, if you ever hear them, he's quite chatty and lighthearted. And it's really nice. It's fun. Get to know him. But also, I mean, if you hear his the story of the Preaching and Preachers thing, apparently, it's very interesting. At Westminster Seminary at that time, there were a number of people who apparently were born again at that time, who until then were, I mean, they were students at Westminster Seminary. So you'd think they would be born again.
Wild.
Yeah.
Well, it's like Spurgeon. The first thing is you need to be converted. Well, if you're going to preach, you need to be converted. You think,
people say it was kind of like a revival. Because he was, and people were hearing him saying stuff they had heard, but I guess, and you know, you know, read between the lines, they were saying, but he's saying the stuff that I've heard, but he's also, it seems actually to have affected him in a way that it hasn't yet affected me. And there are apparently well-known preachers now, and I don't, no one would say their actual names, but who say that, no, that was the time for me. Hearing Lloyd Jones speaking on that, but also Keller's teaching there, what an extraordinary blessing. And I can imagine, as one of the things he kept bringing us back to, it brings us back to the earlier part where you're talking about the gospel, you must get the gospel.
That's right.
And he helped me to see how you must see the gospel in everything.
Yeah,
because you can imagine the night before, you're about to preach, I really want you to get something important about, and you can, what are they going to get?
Yeah.
And he helped us to see the thing they've got to get is the gospel. And I thought Keller was a great help in that sense. Great help. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So what are you up to? What's new with you presently, Tim?
So I've been in my current post. So I was 10 years in LA, pastoring and planting Reality LA. And then we moved to London, Reality Church London. So we were here for 5 years. And then we recently, the last few years, moved back to California. So I'm the pastor for Preaching and Vision at Reality Ventura. And as I said, it's a network.
I got to interrupt you there, because I would like people to hear that that has not just been a career decision for you.
Oh, no.
Because you would like to have been here, but there were medical issues.
The funny moment for a lot of people was leaving LA after 10 years, because the church had grown to a couple thousand people.
Wow.
It was insane. And everything was so established at that time. And yet my wife and I wrestled for a year, like, with this sense that God was saying to us, your work is done.
Wow.
And when I started praying about it, praying with my wife, and then telling our close friends and some of our elders on our staff, and professionally made zero sense if you're looking at it in those terms, we could not resist what we believed to be God calling us here. And he was opening doors and for us to do that. But it required me to leave my position. We sold most of our stuff, you know, to move over here, you know, like in our 30s. Now we had three kids. So I had three daughters. At the time, they were 11, 8, and 3. So we were very much uprooting. Like, it made no sense, you know, on paper. And we thought we were going to be here for 10 years. And then it was towards the latter part of our fifth year here that things became very difficult, as you say, with two of my daughters, but different reasons. And that just really led us to go, God, what are you doing in this? And then that's where the opportunity came for us to, through relationships we had with other churches in our small network, it opened up the opportunity for us to come to Ventura. And even Ventura is an unlikely place for us. It's like a beach city. I'm not a beach guy. I didn't grow up around the beach and everyone just like, you know, it's like that whole culture, but we just sense the call of God in it. It's never made sense per se on paper for us. It's always been about God. What are you calling us to do? Where, how can we best serve and use the gifts that you have given us in this season of life? And towards the latter time in here in London, I just came to the realization that ministry and family weren't friends. It felt like they were enemies. That was often my prayer to God. Like, Lord, the church is doing great here. And I love pastoring these people. My wife and I love being here, but our kids are not doing well. So like, you know, what do we do with that? And God's always just reminded me of something we all know, but we often don't emphasize, is that my family needs to come before ministry. And if I'm not caring for my family, then I can't rightly minister, you know, anyway. And I'm not saying at the first sign of hardship, we change course, but it became very clear that God was changing our course through the hardship. But now, even though it's kind of an unlikely place for us to land in Ventura, it's been a very beautiful thing to see my daughters come alive in their faith. I think just the season of life and the support system that we have in that church there, it's just been really good for us to grow together just as a family, even before we think about ministry. So so that's where we're currently at. And then I help lead our network of churches with one of the other pastors who's in San Francisco. So we lead it together, and that's really what we're working on right now, is after COVID and after all that and after I've moved, how can we get back on track with planting churches, which is what we've always felt called to do, but we never had a vision to plant a lot of churches. We wanted to have a very deliberate and slow relational process of planting churches. So that's kind of just been what we've believed to be our call as a little network. So our little slogan was, we don't want to plant a lot of churches, but healthy churches.
Come on.
Health is always going to, you know, fluctuate depending on how they're led and, you know, what every church is up to at that time. But we at least want to give them the best shot that they possibly have. Not this like scaled, hey, you know, let's get 100 people and let's train them in 2 months and send them out on the, which is a very like American Henry Ford, you know, factory kind of mentality to church planting. We did not want to do that. Just if there are specific people who are called and we feel called to them, to support them, then we'll invest time, prayer, money, resources into them in a slow process to, you know, send them out. And that's how we've planted all of the 9 churches that we have. So I'm leading that right now, and involved in some other networks as well that I'm grateful to be a part of. A lot of people here are familiar with John Mark Comer. So he's been an old friend of mine, and we lead a group together called C-Rock, which is like a pastor's training program, which is pretty broad in terms of where people come from and their denominational, you know, history. But we just, we invest in them every year. It's like a 6-month long cohort program that we work on. So glad to be a part of that as well as a bunch of other things.
I was only quoting that guy yesterday, John Mark Comer. He made that observation, which is pretty strong. And he said, I'm paraphrasing, but it was along the lines of, in the last generations, pastors would, if they're going to slip, they would slip into immorality, alcoholism. This generation, they're slipping into dissipation, just wasting time.
Yeah.
And I thought, now that is a helpful word.
Yeah.
Because it looks so innocuous to simply waste time. But if we had been told, you know, 20 years ago, you'll be spending hours a day scrolling.
Yeah.
You'd say, no, I break that. That can't happen. Right. But and as you're saying, you have to mortify that flesh, but you do it by the Spirit. Yeah. There's something better. No one comes away from 3 hours on Instagram saying, I had a great time.
Nope.
And I thought that was a very important voice. It was a sort of prophetic sort of observation.
Yeah, he really does have a prophetic voice into that. You know, it's a spiritual issue. It's not just like, delete your Instagram. It's like there's something deeper in the heart that's going on there that if it wasn't Instagram, it's going to be something else.
Yes.
So if we don't do or allow the Spirit to do that like surgical work, then we're just going to replace one idol with another idol. Like, what is it? And that's where someone like John Mark's just been so helpful. Like, get to the root of that and
that word coming up again, relational. Is this something you bring?
Yeah, it's part of our ministry philosophy. We've always tried to, with our church network, it's theological, relational, and missional. we generally think about it in that order. I know that's not novel or unique or anything, but, you know, theological, it's God-centered, it's word-centered, it's spirit-led. But the fruit of that should be, we should think about ministry in terms of our relational ecosystem and making sure that's healthy.
Yeah.
And then as the outflow of that is mission. And the problem is, I think for me and for many, is if you reprioritize that, it's like mission first, and then God, and then relationships, or, you know, relationships, and then God, and then mission. You know, it all kind of gets out of whack. It's like, no, it's God-centered. But then before we just jump to mission, it's like, well, who are we with?
Yeah, yeah.
Because if that's not aligned properly and healthy, then it's going to absolutely affect the mission.
Dan Strange is so helpful on this stuff, because he points out this is a gospel issue. What the world already wants, you know, they already want the happy ever after. They already want the marriage that works. They already want community. They only get that in the gospel.
That's right.
And your regular believer can, I can show you that. I mean, and I can't necessarily explain it all ontologically and all that, but I can. That's in my life.
That's right.
And that they say, well, come along, I'll show you. Excellent. So finally, I'd like to ask you, and this sounds grand and so on, but what would your advice be to people who are listening to this? And that is as broad as you like.
When we think about ministry and all the, both the obstacles and the opportunities of our current culture, all ministry should flow from intimacy. Mm. It's the advice I find that I most need to repeat to myself, as well as to my staff teams that I lead, to my friends, to a lot of other peers and people in ministry. Like, whenever anything's just going off the rails a little bit, it always stems from that slight need for alignment with our just, this is so basic, and yet we move past it. And the passage that always comes to mind is Mark chapter 3, when Jesus calls the disciples. I love the way it's phrased, is he called them first to be with him, and then that he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. It's with him. And if any ministry is going to be fruitful, it's going to flow from intimacy. So whatever I've got to do, whatever we've got to do to guard that, whether it's my time in the Word, not to get a sermon out of it, my prayer life, not to just say I prayed, or, you know, whatever, not that performative stuff, but genuinely to just be near to Jesus, be aware of his presence at all times. Like, that's where the power is.
This is it.
And the second part is value character over gifting. One of the things that grieves my heart when I look back to my earlier years of ministry is that I was valuing gifting over character. And one of the things that grieves me when I look around, like, the church landscape, is how much we prize gifting over character. And then we're surprised when there's these epic falls, moral failures, and whatnot. And personally, it wasn't quite so dramatic, but I was given my first sabbatical 10 years ago, and I'm not a natural journaler, but I was just writing things that God was revealing just in my life day by day, you know, no agenda, just kind of whatever I sensed the Spirit revealing in my life. But when I got to the end of my sabbatical, I sensed that God was wanting me to go back through it and highlight everything I learned in two categories, strengths and weaknesses. So if I look back through my journal of 3 months of observation, what do I notice in two categories? And I wrote down all the things I saw that were strengths in my life. And then I wrote down all the things that seemed to be areas of weakness in my life. And as I did the list, when I got to the end, it was this aha moment, because all of my strengths were gifting. All of my weaknesses were character issues. And then I had the terrible idea to take this list to my wife and say, is this true? And she went through it. And she's like, you know, in a very loving, gentle, but powerful way, like, yeah, it's true. And, you know, there's no gross sin or anything there, but it was like, I just was not giving attention to these things, but I was kind of riding on the, you know, the impact of the giftings. And we were like, well, everything must be fine, because this is all going fine. I'm able to do the job and all this stuff. And yet, if I wasn't paying attention to these, it was like God saying, hey, if you're not aligned with me in these areas and attentive to these parts of your character, like, it's going to be that just trajectory that begins to go away from me. And it's what I have to preach to myself. It's what I have to preach to our staff. I'm like, please, please, please don't get so focused on your gifting or your productivity that you neglect your character, because character trumps gifting. And more of that in our discipleship and mentoring and training, just that emphasis on your character should control how you use your gifting, not the other way around.
and character has all those issues to do, all those things which actually most people in the congregation are fighting are character things.
That's right.
And that is where we, if we're not hitting there, it's not helping them as it might. Boy, well, if anyone listening to this is not stirred to pray, listen again. You will be. It's been fantastic to have this time with you. Bless your heart, Tim. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ben.
For more episodes of the Christian Heritage London podcast, and for information on Christian Heritage London events, tours, and walks, please go to christianheritagelondon.org.